is just the inefficiencies of giving money to people and then taking it back via the income tax.
The state Senate continues to be at odds with the House over the prospect of an income tax. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Dan Sullivan faces constituents in a crowded Homer Forum.
Enthusiastically voted for Scott Pruitt, okay? I did. Okay, now come on, you guys.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaskans have a chance to give their opinion on an income tax tonight. Senators gave the tax a cool reception earlier today. Anchorage Republican Senator Kevin Meyer says his constituents oppose creating a new bureaucracy to collect an income tax while the permanent fund continues to pay dividends.
I think that's the part that's the hardest for people to accept, is just the inefficiencies of giving money to people and then taking it back via the income tax.
The House passed the income tax on April 15th. The House would require the income tax and an oil and gas tax increase if the state lowers permanent fund dividends and draws from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. The Constitution bars the legislature from dedicating money for future spending, but House members say the tax should be designated to fund schools. It's expected the income tax would raise about a quarter of the money needed to close the nearly $3 billion gap between what the state spends and what it raises. State Tax Division Chief Ken Alper says it's important to bring the state budget into balance. Alper says if there's a gap in the budget like the Senate majority has proposed, then the state risks making unplanned draws from permanent fund earnings.
That's where the biggest danger lies, because we have a permanent fund right now with very strict rules around it. Everyone knows what those rules are. We pay dividends, we generally do inflation proofing, we fund its own internal operations, and that's it. If we're going to change the way we manage the permanent fund, that is a generationally significant decision for Alaskans.
The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee was scheduled to begin hearing public testimony at 6 p.m. A former Department of Corrections officer convicted of smuggling drugs into Goose Creek Correctional Center was sentenced today to 8 months in federal prison. Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports.
33-year-old Adam Jason Spindler pled guilty in August 2016 to one count each of drug conspiracy and possession of controlled substances with the intent to distribute. Spindler was arrested in May 2016 after heroin and marijuana were discovered in a bag he was attempting to bring into the prison. Spindler later admitted to the Federal Bureau of Investigation he intended to distribute the drugs to an inmate. Department of Corrections Commissioner Dean Williams says he is content with the sentence.
I think it really reinforces the dangerous nature of drug trafficking in prisons, and it reinforces the fact that if you do this kind of activity, there are real serious consequences. And I, as commissioner, I was hoping that message would be sent in today's sentencing, and I think it is.
According to a press release, U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason noted a variety of impacts stemming from introducing drugs into a prison environment, including the betrayal of public trust. And she says the sentence is intended to send a message to others that similar conduct will not be tolerated. Public trust is an aspect Commissioner Williams says he takes seriously.
We are all going to hold ourselves as employees in this department, from me all the way down to the janitor, that we're all going to hold ourselves accountable in a high degree of public trust.
One of the incidents took place in May 2016 when Spindler conspired with inmate Edward Wayne George and George's girlfriend Taylor Hunter. The DA's office says Spindler contacted Hunter around 35 times. The two coordinated the drug delivery. Spindler was paid about $1,400 altogether. Inmate Edward Wayne George was sentenced in April to 33 months in prison and 3 years of supervised release for his role. Hunter is scheduled to be sentenced in May. In addition to jail time, Adam Spindler was sentenced to 3 years of supervised release, forfeiture of his truck, a $1,400 fine, and 120 hours of community service. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska yesterday filed a suit against the city of Homer. The suit targets the proposed recall of three Homer City Council members. The recall stems from a pair of resolutions either introduced or supported by the council members. One resolution supported the Standing Rock Tribe in their effort to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. The other was a resolution to promote inclusivity on the heels of President Donald Trump's election. However, some locals felt the resolutions were handled improperly. Recall petitions were issued earlier this year for Donna Adderhold, Katriona Reynolds, and David Lewis after certification by the city clerk. The lawsuit alleges the city is violating the First Amendment rights of the council members. The ACLU claims the recall petition should never have been certified by the city clerk. The suit cites a handful of other cases that also deal with public officials speaking on issues in their respective communities. Casey Reynolds, the ACLU of Alaska's spokesperson, says the suit was filed now in the hopes that the election set for June 13th can be canceled. Senator Dan Sullivan visited Homer for a meet and greet on Friday afternoon. It was one of the few opportunities the general public of South Central Alaska had to meet with the senator during the two-week congressional recess that just ended. The gathering was scheduled to take place in the Port and Harbor Conference Room on the Homer Spit, but so many people showed up they had to move the meeting outdoors. KBBI's Carolyn Norton was there and has the story.
Senator Sullivan stood behind a small desk placed on the Port and Harbor lawn. He outlined his agenda and praised some of President Trump's appointees.
Wilbur Ross in terms of commerce, Zinke, Navy SEAL, who's now the Secretary of Interior, General Mattis. I think they're going to be really good.
As a Marine, he says he supports Trump's promised increase in military spending.
National defense is something I believe in. President Obama cut our defense spending by almost 25%.
Despite public notice of less than 24 hours, more than 70 locals were on hand to hear Sullivan's remarks. Attendees sat and stood on the lawn and on the concrete Port and Harbor walkway. They often audibly disagreed with the senator. When it came time for the question and answer session, former four-term Homer Mayor Jack Cushing spoke first.
I'm from a Marine Corps family, and I know you are taught not to blame the other guy. I personally thought Obama did a very good job, and I just like to encourage, particularly now that we're not politicking anymore, the campaign's over, it's not the other guy's fault. Let's just make things work.
Another person asked Sullivan about his support for Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt, who doubts that humans are the primary cause of climate change.
Well, I voted for Scott Pruitt. I actually enthusiastically voted for Scott Pruitt, okay? I did. Okay, now come on, you guys.
Don Lane of Homer, captain of the Predator, challenged Sullivan on his opposition to President Obama's signature health insurance law. Lane called it a game changer for his family.
For many years as a commercial fisherman, health insurance wasn't available at any price. It just wasn't available. And along came the Affordable Care Act, and it has been very important.
Another attendee asked if Sullivan would pledge to support the continuation of the pieces of the Affordable Care Act that help families struggling with opioid addiction in the event that Congress eventually repeals the ACA. Sullivan told the crowd he has been pushing for what he calls repeal and repair of Obamacare.
I can tell you this. I'm not going to say on Medicaid expansion where I commit, but I can tell you I'm going to continue to try to find additional resources for people struggling with this kind of addiction.
Sullivan's office staff in Kenai says the senator stopped for a visit at the Danilchik Senior Center on his trip back up the peninsula. On the Homer Spit, I'm Carolyn Norton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a popular Juneau playground goes up in flames and two local teens are arrested.
The material on the playground itself being basically shredded tires, that in itself is a fuel source.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
House Bill House Bill 211, sponsored by Kiana Democrat Dean Westlake, met opposition in a House session early Monday afternoon. The act would require, through statute, that non-resident hunters have a hunting guide present to hunt caribou from the Western Arctic, Central Arctic, porcupine, and Tashikpuk herds. Westlake said during the House session that passing HB 211 would put Alaska on par with regulations applied to the Canadian half of the porcupine caribou herd. Opposition for the regulation came from North Pole's Tammy Wilson, Kenai's Gary Knopp, Big Lake's Mark Newman, and Healy's Dave Telrico. Representative Wilson says she trusts the Board of Game and that regulation for what Westlake proposed already exists.
But I just want to make it clear that the Board of Game right now has tools it can use, even in this instance. They can make non-resident hunter apply for a drawing permit. The Board of Game can limit those number of permits and reduce the number of non-residents in the field.
Representative Newman added that trying to provide management of wildlife through statute is difficult because it's not as flexible as regulations set by the Board of Game. After the four opposing representatives presented, the session was moved to the next day's calendar, leaving the possibility for a vote tomorrow or a future date. The two teens arrested for setting the Twin Lakes playground on fire Monday have confessed, and Juneau's fire marshal has completed his investigation. Capital City Fire Rescue Fire Marshal Dan Jaeger says the two teenagers admitted they started the fire with no clear motive.
They admitted as to how they did that, and, you know, because they are juveniles and it's still an open case, I'm not allowed to comment on that.
Jaeger also noted no accelerants were used, such as gasoline.
The material on the playground itself being basically shredded tires, that in itself is a fuel source. Between the wind and the fact you had basically the tire material burning, that once it burns, it turns into a liquid, so it's kind of a petroleum product at that point. That's really what caused the fire to intensify and spread all the way across the playground the way it did.
Jaeger says many photos of the early stages of the fire shared through social media were critical in the investigation. The images help narrow down where the fire began and how it spread. If the playground is rebuilt, Jaeger recommends using different materials.
Granted, it's not as soft or easy to land on, but gravel doesn't burn, at least not that easily. So sand, gravel, things like that, stuff that is non-combustible is the recommendation.
The Juneau Community Foundation is accepting donations to rebuild the playground. The Matanuska-Susitna Borough's proposed budget is out, and it's smaller than last year. If approved, the budget for the fastest-growing population center in the state would shrink just a little to about $400 million. The plan keeps school funding the same as last year. Matsu Borough Manager John Moosey says the borough prides itself on having the leanest personnel-to-resident ratio of any municipality in the state.
I think what it shows is that we're trying to provide services the most economical way possible. I can probably rip off a dozen new positions that I need that would really help us with our mission. It's just when the money is not there, you don't go there. You do the best with what you have.
Moosey says cuts have not been proposed across the board, and the borough has tried to prioritize parts of the budget like public safety and schools while putting off expenses for things like new equipment or vehicles. Moosey says as the number of people living in the Matsu has gone up, state funding has dropped. Considering the state's revenue is so dependent on oil production and forecasts are not optimistic, Moosey says he does not expect the state's budget woes to end anytime soon.
There's no other conclusion to draw other than there is less money for state operations and government, and we have to make sure we're providing services at a fair rate for our citizens.
The Matsu budget will go to the Assembly after public hearings this week. Members of the public can testify at the Borough Assembly Chambers in Palmer this evening. Tomorrow, public testimony will be held in Willow at the Community Center at 6 p.m. After that, the Matsu Borough Assembly will take up the budget. The fate of the Polaris building drew public testimony at a Fairbanks City Council meeting last night as an ordinance to keep the long-vacant downtown high-rise under city control was considered. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, many who addressed the council spoke against plans to demolish the neglected former hotel.
The owner of the Polaris Hotel owes thousands of dollars in back property taxes. If a portion of the taxes aren't paid by the end of May, the property would go to the borough. On Monday night, the Fairbanks City Council advanced an ordinance that would allow the city to retain ownership of the property. The building has seen better days and contains asbestos and other contaminants. Many would like to see it torn down, but several who testified Monday addressed the bottom line. Mike Music argued restoring the Polaris made good economic sense.
I suggest that we take a good hard look at how it might integrate with the plans for the Performing Arts Building and the Convention Center. I think we can save many millions of dollars and probably gather many millions of dollars if we finesse this properly.
The price tag for demolishing the Polaris could run to $6 million. Robert Shields sees hydroponic gardening in the Polaris, and he says dealing with the contaminants would be necessary if the building stands or falls.
We've discovered preliminary structural upgrades could cost under $1 million. And I think that's very significant considering the prices that the city is looking at to tear it down.
The ordinance would also see the city paying the borough the tens of thousands of dollars in back taxes if the owner defaults. Sponsor David Pruse says while it might be cheaper to let the borough hold the building, it wouldn't be the right thing to do.
This is a long project that the Fairbanks North Star Borough has been very amenable to us on, and this is what the cost is. I'd love to have seen that thing refurbished, redone, but it's not going
to
happen.
The council voted to advance the ordinance to the next meeting. By then, Councilman Pruse hopes to have a plan in place to pay the taxes. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Alaska Pacific University Early Honors Program satisfies high school graduation requirements while students earn college credits from a regionally accredited institution. Apply at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Last week, Russian military planes flew near Alaska's coast on four separate occasions. American military intercepted two of the flights, and Canadian fighters joined their U.S. counterparts during the fourth intercept on the northern Arctic coast. All were legal in international airspace, and American military leaders have downplayed concerns. Heather Connolly is the Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. She says these Russian incursions are meant to test U.S. military readiness.
You hate to see the testing part. All countries do test. But I would argue what we've seen in the last week is a real burst of intense activity that we haven't seen since 2015, to have four exercises within a short period of time. The Pentagon, at least in its description, believes that the Russians may be testing out their new long-range bomber, and I think also wanting to go to places that they hadn't tested our response time. So I think that's probably what's been going on.
Any reason to think that there's something else provoking or prompting this string of flyouts?
I think in part we could see it could be, again, it's very difficult to get into the minds of exactly the Kremlin and Russian military leaders, but I think you could put it in context to beefing up a response since the United States launched 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Syria. I think you could also see it in light of U.S. aircraft carrier movement towards North Korea. Also, the Russians have responded by deploying some forces to their border with North Korea. So I think in some ways it's a bit of posturing. It's to demonstrate that, like the United States, Russia has a global military reach. They can do multiple things in multiple geographic arenas, and they are an equal, as they want to be seen, as an equal militarily to the United States.
How risky is it every time this happens that it could escalate into something much larger in an unintended kind of a side risk?
Well, there is always risk, particularly when our militaries are operating in very close proximity in the same theater. The concern for most Pentagon officials is how closely we are operating with the Russian military over Syria and Syrian airspace. And that's why we have tried to take a lot of important steps in deconfliction, because we don't want an accident. I would say that Russian behavior has tried to be as provocative as it can be, certainly closer to the Baltic Sea region and the Black Sea region, where Russian aircraft have come within, I believe it was 100 feet of the USS Donald Cook in the Black Sea. They have come very dangerously close to civilian aircraft that are flying over the Baltic Sea region. Again, this is very dangerous. You know, what you don't want to see is an accident that escalates to, you know, potential conflict.
We know that Russia is militarily building up along the northern Arctic coast. What are your observations about this? Is it the right and responsible thing to do, given an increasingly open Arctic and more vessel traffic, more potential for search and rescue, or is this something else?
Well, actually, the last couple of days, in addition to the air incursions near Alaska, we've been given a pretty visual picture of President Putin observing ice glaciers, as well as a new military outpost in the Russian Arctic. I think all of these, again, create a background that the Arctic remains very important to Russia economically as well as militarily. There is a growing military posture to all of this, I think, which is concerning. Does it mean that we're going to see a major U.S. military buildup in the Arctic? No, we don't need to do that. But we need to have a much clearer focus. We have to understand what the Russians are trying to achieve militarily. It appears to me they're trying to deny access to the U.S. and NATO of the strategic areas in the North Pacific and the North Atlantic. That's what we have to challenge that a bit. It's not a huge military buildup, but we do have to enhance our readiness and our military posture to be prepared for anything. As this past week's incursions show us, the Russians are testing our readiness.
Heather Conley is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. A longer version of this interview is on our website, alaskapublic.org. The U.S. Coast Guard rescued three seal hunters on Saturday off the coast of Hooper Bay after the group ran out of gas. KYUK's Christine Trudeau reports.
39-year-old Joseph Lake texted his brother-in-law Friday evening saying that he, his cousin, and nephew were anchored in the Bering Sea. Lake had 5% battery on his phone and had just drifted into cell phone range. His brother-in-law then contacted state troopers, who decided to wait out the poor visibility and weather conditions at sea to dispatch Hooper Bay search and rescue the next day. As night grew darker, Lake and crew realized no one would be searching until morning and settled in for the night. Lake says they used a tarp for cover, had drinking water, warm tea, coffee, and seal oil along with other native foods.
We had a lot of dried seal meat from our previous trips of seal hunting, and we also had dried pike from our trips that we went up to the Yukon to fish. We had dried smelts from the bay here.
The next day, when Hooper Bay search and rescue team couldn't find the seal hunters in the choppy surf and strong winds, they called in the U.S. Coast Guard, who sent out a C-130 airplane that located the boat around 5 p.m. Saturday. The airplane circled overhead while search and rescue met the missing seal hunters, gave them gas, and escorted them back to port. Coast Guard official Meredith Manning says it's always good to have more than one form of communication, especially in Alaskan waters, and recommends boaters carry a VHF radio. Rescued seal hunter Joseph Lake is an experienced seal hunter and says he usually hunts in a group of other boats that have VHF radios. But when he became separated from the group due to choppy water conditions with high swells, he was unable to use the radio.
Leona's Island, and thank everybody that was out there searching for us and everybody that participated in, you know, getting us home.
Lake was prepared to create a makeshift sail from a tarp to get home had they not been found. Since getting home Saturday, he's already bought two VHF radios for his next trip. For KYUK, I'm Christine Trudeau.
How can the Chilista region reduce its fossil fuel use, increase energy efficiency, and use those changes to create jobs? That's the question a group of YK Delta communities and energy organizations gathered in Bethel last week to begin answering. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports for direction and inspiration. The group turned to four villages on Kuskokwim Bay, where those changes are already happening.
We have wind energy that has more than enough capacity to light the whole village. So we captured the extra energy and we heated homes.
Roderick Phillip is the vice chairman of the Chininik Wind Group, a wind energy partnership between Kangiganak, Kwigilinak, Tuntutuliak, and Kipnuk. The group operates, maintains, and installs its own renewable energy wind systems. Phillip is also the general manager of the Kangiganak Power Company, which installed wind turbines almost 5 years ago. Since then, about a third of the village's electric energy has come from wind. 20 homes in the village also have stoves that are fueled by wind power. They're ceramic units called thermal stoves. Those homes have cut their heating fuel consumption in half, and 30 more homes are set to receive stoves this year. Phillip says all those savings on heating fuel are being spent on another fuel, gasoline.
To hunt fish, gather from the land and sea, to fill our freezers, and put food on our table.
There's another way strengthening the village's renewable energy system has strengthened the ability to subsist, by providing jobs.
I have four wind techs, two operators, two laborers. Employed.
These employees run the entire utility system, and together with the other Chininik villages, they'll be installing wind turbines for Kipnuk next year. More energy projects are happening in the region. Chafornik is ordering wind turbines. Kwithluk has secured federal microloans for residents to make their homes more energy efficient. And Quinnahock is working to increase energy efficiency in its public buildings. That will save the tribe, city, and village corporation $50,000 annually. The technology exists for the Delta to reduce its fossil fuel use and to eventually power itself off renewables. Multiple Delta communities are already heading in that direction. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Shady Grove Oliver and Carolyn Norton in Homer, Tyler Stupp in Nome, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Christine Trudeau and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Josh Edge and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.